We're going to go into momentum. I remember last time, actually, I had talked about going into rotational motion. We're not going into rotational motion until after the next midterm. So the next midterm is next Wednesday. After that is when we go into rotational motion. Right now, we're going to finish up some energy conservation things with momentum conservation and combine it with energy conservation and talk about collisions, and that will close us up for getting ready for this midterm at least. Happy birthdays, as usual, go out. Hugh Jackman, Wolverine, today's Wolverine's birthday. Today's PETA's birthday, Josh Hutcherson of The Hunger Games. Luciano Pavarotti, who's one of the most famous tenors of all time. And then a couple of scientists, John Moffat, Arthur Hardin. Arthur Hardin was actually a biochemist in the early part of the 20th century who, of all things, got a Nobel Prize studying fermentation. And I'm sure he drank some of his experiments in the process. So Yom Kippur, today is Yom Kippur, so please salute your Jewish friends as well who are fasting today. And it's a pity because they're missing out on National Gumbo Day. Well, after sunset they can have their gumbo. So while all of you were here, presumably, or a lot of you were here, I was off this weekend in Cincinnati, dressed up and looking pretty because this weekend was my brother's wedding, and I was his best man. So this is my brother, kid brother Sean, and his beautiful new bride, Kanisha, at their wedding on Sunday night. So wish them, a happy honeymoon and a happy life as well. I come from one of those weird families. My brother is younger than my daughter, and my granddaughters were flower girls at my brother's wedding. So it's kind of weird that way. In any event, though, it was a great weekend, and I apologize if I'm slow because I'm still recovering. So speaking of covering, recovering, and recovering what we've covered, here's kind of the semester in review so far, right? We've covered all kinds of physical quantities and vectors, the physical quantities, all of units and significant figures and all of that stuff. We did all kinds of work in kinematics in one and two dimensions. So you remember there were three kind of standard kinematics equations that we used in one or two dimensions. We briefly covered centripetal acceleration. A equals V squared over R for an object moving in a circular arc at a constant speed. And then we went into all the applications of Newton's laws. The first law, right? Things that are in motion tend to stay in motion. The second law, F equals MA, and it's a vector equation, so it's really three equations. And then the third law that forces act in equal and opposite pairs. We went into all the static stuff, and then we went into friction, potential energy, and work. The exam essentially covers the Newton's laws and work and energy and what we're about to cover. So the second midterm will not really include that much on centripetal acceleration or kinematics. You may need to know a little bit of it to solve some pieces of problems, maybe, because physics is one of those things where you build on previous knowledge and you're collecting skills and collecting techniques through the course of the class. But for the most part, the midterm will concentrate on those. People have asked me, so I'm going to assemble some example problems, and even probably what I'll do is I'll take the midterm that I had from the last time I taught this course and give you guys a copy of that midterm and a link to the solution guide for that midterm, so you know what to expect. I know it was a little difficult with the first midterm, not knowing kind of the scope or the expected scope. So this time I'm giving you a little sneak peek. In the process, I'm also making my job a little harder because I can't give you last semester's midterm this semester because I'm giving it to you beforehand as a study guide, right? So, but you'll see the kind of problems I give. I've also got some other problems that I'll work out and distribute along with the homework, of course, later on this afternoon, due next week to practice before the exam. So hopefully a little bit of a study guide will help you focus in on precisely the concepts you need to succeed on this next one. Are there any questions about that so far? So good, so far so good. It feels like Monday morning, even though it's Wednesday, doesn't it? And the light is changing too, which always distracts me. So far so good. I'm going to connect now forces and Newton's laws into the next thing we're talking about, which is momentum. And I've commented about momentum before in the class. You've certainly heard the term or been exposed to the term, but having a feeling for how it connects to impulse, how it connects to Newton's second law, is a bit of what I'll talk through now. Don't worry, later on in the day today, I'll be working through problems on the board associated with this, so we can all write some things down. So you knew that work is kind of force applied over a distance. That was the definition of exertion of energy or work being done in one dimension at least, and that's when the force is being applied exactly in the direction of the object that's being moved. The vector form of that and the full calculus vector form of that is that middle form right there where you're really adding up the force dotted with the distance the object moves. And since both of those are vectors, you have to have some way of multiplying them together and getting a scalar out. That's that dot product, a vector dot product. And that integral just means you're adding it up over a bunch of tiny little slices of time or space. Right? So Newton's second law says stuff about not forces over distances, but forces over, you know, applied over times and how something is changing over time. F equals ma. Well, acceleration is just the second derivative of position, right? So we're the first derivative of velocity. So F equals md v dt. Now, you can put the m inside and you can say, okay, here's a quantity. The mass of something times its velocity. And force is defined as how that quantity, that mass and velocity, is changing with time. Now, it may seem funny to think that mass can change. Turns out, in most, you know, macroscopic things, the mass of the chair isn't changing as you exert a force on it. The mass of the box isn't changing as you exert a force on it. The mass of the beanbag, I hope, isn't. But once you get down to the stuff that I do with subatomic particles and E equals mc squared and relativity and all of those crazy things, sure enough, mass changes with time.
For instance, we're pushing something that left a trail behind on the floor.
Well, so another thing that can happen is even slightly... A slightly better example is a chemical rocket. Okay? Rockets are great examples of this type of thing where a macroscopic object is moving, but its reaction mass, the stuff that's blowing out the rocket nozzle to produce thrust, is reducing its mass as it goes. And you end up writing down the differential equation to figure out exactly how that rocket is accelerating because it's got less and less mass to accelerate as it uses up its fuel. Got less and less fuel to accelerate too, right? So, but something like, yes, if things are falling off the chair as I'm pushing it, or if things are, you know, fuel is being lost out of the rocket as it's accelerating, if relativistically something is moving near the speed of light and its mass is changing because of that, all of these are reasons why we put the mass in that derivative. It can change with time. So, and oddly enough, even somebody like Newton 300 years ago knew this. And he posited this formulation of his second law not as F equals ma. He posited it as force is how this quantity, momentum, changes with time. Now, just before you get there, I just talked about rockets. and a force exerted over some period of time, okay, if I move that dt over and say the way that this momentum changes is force times some segment of time, okay, I created a new quantity, just like force times distance was energy. This is now force times time. And exerting a force over a certain amount of time is how the momentum of something changes. And that is called, in physics, an impulse. You'll see it in a couple of homework questions. Impulse is particularly important for people like rocketeers, right? Model rocket engines. I've got this linked into the class notes. There's actually a Wikipedia article on all the different classifications of model rocket engines. And when you burn it, it provides a certain impulse, a certain total momentum change to the rocket that it's firing off at. And it's really fun because that Wikipedia article actually extends that concept to the absurd level of even like Saturn V rockets and stuff like that. Huge, huge commercial rockets or huge NASA rockets. So this momentum, it's funny now because impulse is this product, and you can trade those things off. You can have a smaller force for a longer time. You can have a larger force for a shorter time and still get the same change in momentum, right? So there is the classic example is you get potentially a very large impulse falling out of a tree and landing on concrete. It's a very short time that you're decelerating, and that force is correspondingly very high. But you can calculate what your initial and final momenta are, and you can guess that, oh, okay, I decelerate maybe a tenth of a second or a fifth of a second. And from that, you can roughly guess just what the total force is exerted by the concrete on your poor body as you land. I'll post to the class website a post that I put on Facebook about a squirrel falling out of a tree that a friend wanted me to calculate for them, which is a similar kind of thing. But correspondingly, some of the most interesting and fascinating rocketry going between planets nowadays in your generation, going to Mars, going between planets, is not chemical rockets anymore. It's these ion rockets that have little particle accelerators and produce a very small thrust. So a very small force, but they produce it over a long period of time. You can basically do this almost forever. And then you can produce a very large net change in your momentum because even though it's a small force, it's a long period of time, so it's a large impulse. So, but the thing that really matters today and the stuff that we're going to practice problems on and work through some examples in, particularly with regards to collisions, is momentum. And momentum is that mass times velocity. It's a vector. So you got a tree that like a vector. If you're adding them, you got to add the components. If you're asked for direction and magnitude, you got to calculate the direction from trig and all of that stuff, just like vector forces. Remember, energy was really convenient because energy was a scalar. It was just a number, and we just wrote down this table and added together the numbers. Well, now we're going to have to write down tables of components and work through the components there. So it's a vector. The other thing that you have to be careful about is just like even kinematics and just like anything involving velocities and accelerations, actually, it depends on your reference frame, right? If I say something is moving at a constant velocity v, and then I hop in a car or a sliding chair or whatever and move along with it, all of a sudden it looks like it's not moving relative to me as an observer, right? So whatever laws we come up with, and gosh, we're going to come up with a law, conservation of momentum, that seems to hold everywhere, it shouldn't matter whether or not I'm watching this thing go by or whether I'm walking along with it and watching it collide with something. Any frame that I'm in, any way that I'm moving with a constant velocity relative to the things I'm observing, shouldn't matter. And that's kind of a deep statement. It's not a completely obvious statement, but it'll turn out to be true. And it's got some very kind of deep and profound implications, even getting down to Einstein and relativity stuff. So let's start back out at Newton's third law. We had Newton's second law, F equals ma. Now you know it's not F equals ma. It's F equals dp dt. It's how this mysterious momentum is changing with time, is really Newton's second law. And this particular picture we worked through this example, where we tried to figure out the net acceleration of these two boxes with these forces acting on them. And we had to use Newton's third law and understand that if we treat the boxes individually, they're exerting equal and opposite forces on each other. So those middle forces, right, the box on the right is exerting a force on the box on the left, and the corresponding force from the box on the left acting on the box on the right, those are equal forces pointing in opposite directions. That is Newton's third law, pure and simple, nothing to it. And I actually copied the statement of Newton's third law from Wikipedia up here because it is a good clean statement of what Newton's third law really means. It does not mean that nothing ever moves. It does not mean that if I push on something, it exactly pushes back on me to counter my push. It means that if I'm talking about, if my system is this ball and I exert a force on this ball, okay, it moves, this beanbag. But if I talk about the system as my hand, when I throw it, the beanbag is exerting a force back on my hand that is exactly equal to and opposite the force that my hand exerts on the beanbag. So with that being said, okay, we got a picture. We got a picture of two objects with forces going on between them. You've got all the tools necessary to handle that because we've already talked through Newton's application of Newton's laws. So now let's take out those external forces. Put them aside for a second. And just talk about these two boxes. Now that could be a picture, a frame of a movie where those boxes, you know, were colliding, right? One was coming in and hitting the other. Or they were both coming in and hitting each other. It could be a moment in time where a collision between those boxes is occurring and then they move off on their own, in their own ways again. So I've got a net force acting on these boxes now. I eliminated all the external net forces, so the total net force is zero, because the forces in between those boxes are equal and opposite, right? So that also means, well, net force, Newton's second law, is how momentum changes with time. And I can take that momentum of the system and break it up in the momentum of each one of the individual guys. And now what this kind of magically says, and it's a beautiful statement, is that this combination of things, this total momentum of these two boxes, its derivative with respect to time is zero. Anything that has a derivative with, you know, if that's zero, is a constant. It doesn't change with time. So the net momentum of the system, if you add together, now as a vector quantities, the momenta of those two boxes, regardless of what happened in between them, this doesn't say anything about the forces in between them. They're equal and opposite. They kind of cancel each other out there. As long as there are no external forces, the total momentum is conserved. So let's take this and let's apply it to something now. Let's run a movie where, okay, this is just one frame of that movie, a collision moment, but let's look at before and after, because before and after, if total momentum is conserved, it doesn't care about time. It doesn't care about before and after anymore. So now I can total up before and after in time. and do a calculation. So I've got, you know, let's see, two objects that are sitting on a table, on a frictionless table. And for the moment, I just, you know, kind of assume, okay, the force exerted by the table is equal to the force of gravity, so those two forces cancel each other out. It's like having no net external forces at all. I've got one box, and I've got another box, and I've got a spring in between them. And the first box is 1 kilogram, and the second box is 3 kilograms. And afterwards, I'm going to release that spring. And the first mass moves to the left at 2 meters per second. So I have a picture that looks roughly kind of like this tiny little thing. Let's see. Give or take. Okay? So this is before, and this is after. You can also call them initial and final, whatever you want, right? And the question is, what is the final velocity of this guy? And you can approach this in a very similar way to the energy conservation problems. You can look at it and say, okay, well, there is, I've got the total momentum. I got P1 and I got P2. And remember, P is equal to MV. Here, there's really only one dimension, and let's call that the positive direction. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to draw this little table, so before and after. And sure enough, before neither one of them is moving, right? So before, momenta are both zero of each one of those boxes. But after, okay, now I've got a mass M1 times the velocity pointing in the negative direction. So this is something like 1 kilogram times minus 2 meters per second. And remember, I've got to get that sign right. It's pointing in the negative direction the way I've drawn this. And P2 is this mass 2, 3 kilograms. Times that second velocity. So let's write down the sum of each one of these lines. That one's 0 across the board. This one's 3V2 minus 2, right? And there's a kilograms in there. There's actually a kilogram meters per second here. So 3V2 minus 2 equals 0, right? Before and after, the total momenta are equal. That's what conservation momentum means. That means that 3v2 minus 2 is equal to 0, and then v2 is equal to 2/3 meters per second. Because that's the units if you write down all the units. So one goes off, flying off at 2 meters per second, The other one is moving substantially more slowly because it's more massive, right? It's heavier. That's not a big surprise, but now you can treat it quantitatively, right? You can actually get the absolute number of the total velocity at the end. Now, this may seem, you know, somewhat trivial. This is the easy case. We'll get into harder cases in a second. And trust me, we'll get into very hard cases in a little bit after that. But this is the essence of the path, right? Draw the picture, label all your vectors, decompose your vectors if you have to, apply conservation of momentum, so write down your little table, and then the sum of the momenta before and after in each dimension has to be equal to zero. You could also do conservation of energy, too. Here you don't, the problem wasn't phrased enough for you to really use conservation of energy. You don't know anything about that spray. But what I could do is I could certainly calculate, now that I know this velocity, I can calculate the kinetic energy of this guy and the kinetic energy of this guy. So I can calculate the total final kinetic energy. That energy had to come from somewhere in the initial system. There was no initial kinetic energy. It had to come from the spring. So if you knew something about the spring, you could even tell what the spring constant was or how far the spring was compressed, because all the stored energy of that spring, 1/2 kx squared, has to go into kinetic energy of the final system too. But you don't need conservation of energy to do this problem, right? All you need is conservation of momentum. And generally, problems like this, the thing that should trigger you off to say, ooh, I need to use conservation of momentum in this problem, is things that have a clear before and after state, where the particles are coming in, or boxes, or whatever they are. They do something together, and then they go off again, right? That's before and that's after. And they interacted somewhere in the middle, and there are no external forces. And if you've got all of those settled, you know conservation of momentum has to apply. One of the classic cases where that's the case is kind of what I do for a living. We smash subatomic particles together. Coming in, boom, something magic happens, boom, stuff comes out. You throw things in, they interact, they come back out again. And believe it or not, conservation momentum even applies down at the quantum level and relativity and all of that other stuff. It's universal as far as we can tell, right down to the point where there was a famous experiment about 70 years ago where somebody did an experiment like that where they smashed some particles together and stuff popped out that did not look like it conserved momentum. And they knew that they had to have some ghost particle coming out somewhere that they didn't see in their detectors, but it had to be carrying that extra momentum. And in fact, there was. It was called the neutrino, and that was the origin of the neutrino, yeah, discovery of the neutrino. What was that?
Photons work slightly less well.
Yeah, photons interact electromagnetically, so at least you can stop them. So you got all kinds of detectors that work really well for photons, including these, right? Your original photon detectors, otherwise known as your eyes. So here's, I put in the class notes the setup, right, with all of the various details. And I wrote down the initial and final momenta. And from that, you can get the same thing that I got there, which is the final velocity is 2/3 of a meter per second using conservation momentum. So that is, that's a relatively straightforward thing because the initial momentum of the system, nothing was moving. A lot of the problems that you see in textbooks, if you open up the textbooks and look at the problems at the end of the chapter on conservation of momenta, will be things like this. It'll be a firecracker was sitting here and exploded into 5 pieces, and they all went this way and that way. And yes, okay, the initial firecracker had no momentum. And the final pieces all have to have zero net momentum, so you can figure out if you add all of those final momenta together, you better get zero. Momentum better be conserved. Or if you throw the firecracker, it's got some initial momentum, and then it explodes, and all those pieces together better add up to the same as the initial momentum of the firecracker before it exploded.
And if it's not, neutrinos are responsible.
Or neutrinos are probably responsible, or photons, or who knows, you might even discover a heavy photino or an axion and win the Nobel Prize. So let's do a slightly, you know, more involved problem. So that was a classic, it broke apart or it exploded problem, right? Two things connected by a spring or some stored energy that blew apart. Let's do a collision problem now. And so I've got a collision. I've got one mass moving in. Other mass is sitting there. This is a billiard balls or something like that. Although these things are slightly different masses. They're on a frictionless surface. And I've got a key phrase in there. They bounce elastically off of each other. And I'll get into what that means in a second. But what really this is this is you're playing pool with your buddy, and you want to say, okay, I've got this initial state of me hitting that cue ball. What's the final state after I hit that ball? Where are the two balls going? What are their relative velocities? So it's, again, you can do the exact same thing, right? Draw the picture, label the velocities, I used initial and final here. The nomenclature, right, all the variables do get painful because you're going to be writing subscripts until your eyes drop out, because it's now V1 initial and V1 final and V2 initial and V2 final. You have to be organized about these things. But now you can write down the total initial and total final momentum, right? I've got positive direction going to the right. So I know that some of these will have, you know, a velocity pointing to the left or pointing to the right. Some of them will have negative velocities. But right now, I just blindly write down net momentum. M1 V1 plus M2 V2, initial and final. And then plug in the numbers. And what I end up getting, now conservation of momentum says that these two have to be the same. Right, so I set this guy, which is a number, my initial system, equal to this guy, the final number. Uh-oh. Okay, now you have kind of a problem, because I've got one equation, conservation of momentum, but I don't know two things, which is the final velocities of each ball. So there's got to be something else that I can use to figure this out. And the thing that's hidden in there is that magic word elastic means that these things bounce off of each other without losing any energy. And you're going to have to use conservation of energy too. So now you need to work through this problem with conservation of momentum and conservation of energy and calculate it all out. Okay. But once you do that, you have two equations, conservation of momentum, conservation of energy, and two unknowns, and then it's your physics job is done. It's all just algebra after that. So let's, you know, let me show you how to work through that. So I've got these two things. Right, the initial system is this ball is coming in. And this is my V1 initial. Right, is 1 meter per second. And that's a 0.5 kilogram thing. M1 is 0.5 kilograms. Oops. And M2 is 1.0 kilograms. So that's the initial picture, and then the final picture. I think, but I don't know, that they bounce off of each other like this. It could be that this velocity really is pointing to the right, right? That they both move together. I don't know. The math will tell me. So let's just follow the math blindly and see where it goes. This is the one final, and this is the two final. Okay. So first of all, we have momentum. And we have momentum initial and final of the system. And it's for one, and then it's for two, and then it's for the sum of them. And then initially that's M1, V1 initial. The 2 is 0, M1, V1 final. Whoops, M2, V2 final. This is M1, V1 initial, M1, V1 final, plus M2, V2 final. So the conservation of momentum gives me M1, V1 final is equal to M1, V1 initial. 1, V1 final plus M2, V2 final. Okay. At some point you realize that you don't, you know, have to write the little table all the time, particularly for systems like this where the only energies are kinetic energy, right? So I can just write down conservation of energy here. And remember, the kinetic energy of something moving is 1/2 mv². So the initial kinetic energy of the system is 1/2 m1 v1 i². And the final kinetic energy of the system is 1/2 m1 v1 final squared plus 1/2 m2 v2 final squared. Right? That's the initial kinetic energy. That's the final kinetic energy. You can drop all the 1/2s and stuff like that. And now what you've got, you know, from this, the physics is done. Or physics is dumb, if you look at my handwriting here. You've got two equations with two unknowns, V1 and V2 final. So you can solve both of these for them. You can solve this first equation for one of these two velocities and plug it into the second, and then solve that one for the other velocity. And you can chug through the math. It's slightly painful, but it works. The physics here is done, at least. So there's another nice thing is for things like this, and for lots of physics things actually, I like to double check the results a couple of different ways, right? So do they both move the same way? Do they bounce off of each other? Well, one thing you can do is, these aren't necessarily 1 kilogram objects, but they're, you know, not far from it. So I brought some marbles in because I have not lost my marbles yet. And here we have a rather large object and a rather small object. This is like our 0.5 kilogram mass, and this is like our 1 kilogram mass, give or take. Right? And this is, okay, not a frictionless table, but let's pretend it is. And so now I can look at, you know, a collision and see essentially what happens. Now this is rather curious and a little bit counterintuitive even, that what happened is this initial marble, the small marble came in and practically stopped as it hit the larger marble. And depending on exactly how they hit and whether or not the collision is elastic, whether the collision conserves energy or not, you can imagine if this marble was very, very big and very, very heavy, it would look like a wall to this small guy and he'd bounce off, right? On the other hand, if the incoming thing looks like a bowling ball and it's hitting a BB or something very, very small, it's going to basically overrun it, and both of them are going to end up moving in that direction. So let's do a little simulation, too. I got linked into the class notes a collision lab from a place, a group out in, out in Colorado. So, and they put together all these nice little demos, all these nice little JavaScript-y type demos where you can test these things. So I put in a half kilogram object and a 1 kilogram object here. And I'm starting out with a velocity of 1 meter per second. And I'm going to play the movie, right? And it's going to show me, and as a matter of fact, where the objects are. And it's going to run through the collision and then show me the final conditions where, yes, in fact, my smaller object bounced off and my larger object moved off to the right. Interestingly enough, the larger object moves faster, right? That's 2/3 of a meter per second as opposed to the recoil of 1/3 of a meter per second for the smaller guy. And I can restart this simulation and play it again. And even step it back and forth. Now what's really happening, the total momentum that's being exchanged here, the first guy has, you know, a rather large change of momentum because all of his velocity is moving forward and then it turns around. So it's no wonder that his final velocity is a little bit smaller than the big guy. Because he had to turn his velocity completely around. His momentum changed direction. While the larger guy just goes from a dead stop up to some final velocity. I can play with these. I can say, okay, what happens if, in fact, both of the objects have exactly the same mass? Let's say they're both 1 kilogram masses. Are they going to move together? Are they going to bounce off of each other evenly? What do you think happens? One's going to stay and two's going to go is the guess. Okay, well let's look at the math here, right? Because the physics is done. Let me take a picture for those who are not here in class before I fiddle with this screen here. So if the two masses are equal, then I can simplify a lot of things, right? Because all of a sudden these masses cancel out all over the place, just like the 1/2s do. And in fact, what I can find is that the initial velocity and the final velocity here, for these equations to work, they work if that V1 final is equal to zero. You can work through the math there, but if that works, then this ends up being V1 initial is equal to V2 final. V1 initial squared is equal to V2 final squared. Same thing. Both of those make perfect sense. So yes, in fact, if that final velocity of that first object is zero, this works. It's going to come in, it's going to hit a dead stop and transfer all of its momentum to the other guy, to the second ball. So let's run this movie and see if the simulation agrees with what we expect there. Okay? So in fact, that's exactly what happens. The final velocity of the first ball is zero. This is a principle of a fun little toy called Newton's Cradle, right? Those little silver balls in the cage where you pick up one and it hits the other balls, and then the other ball on the other side comes up and they go back and forth again. All of those balls have almost exactly the same mass, and so what they do is they evenly transfer momentum all throughout the system to the other ball, and it looks like a little magic trick. I've got a link in the class notes of all kinds of little magic tricks and games you can do with a Newton's cradle that way. But this is the essence of one-dimensional conservation of momentum, right? And for the most part, these types of problems where you have collisions where energy is conserved, what you do is you write down conservation of momentum, you write down conservation of energy, and you plug and chug. Then it's all algebra after that. Or you plug it into some, you know, plug it into Wolfram Alpha or plug it into Mathematica or whatever your tool is to solve those equations. But you have to give it those equations first. So there is, let's see. So I've been emphasizing, right, for these types of problems, you either have something, you know, exploding into multiple pieces, an initial and a final state, or things coming in, interacting, and then going out again, an initial and a final state. It's usually just two final states. There are going to be some problems that you see that have multiple parts. This thing is coming down, then hitting this, then it's going over there and hitting that thing. You need to break each one of those down into a little initial and final movie, right? Every movie is not just initial and final states. It can be a bunch of little, small movies where you apply conservation of momentum, apply conservation of energy, and go from there. So there's some advanced reading in there for people who are interested about a classic kind of a concern about conservation of momentum is that, well, okay, you know, you've got all these balls bouncing off of each other. You've got things coming apart. But boy, Todd, you know, I do this. Conservation momentum sure doesn't look like it's conserved. I'm bouncing off of something. Bouncing off of the floor. Right? Well, it's not elastic. Even if it was perfectly elastic, even if this was a super ball, and it bounced up and deformed and came back with pretty much the exact same height, what's happening is you're violating one of the ground rules of this thing, which is no external forces. Because, gosh, hitting something that is like a building that extends way out there and down to the earth and all that stuff, there are lots of external forces at play, right? And friction is another one of those things where you're losing energy out into the world, and it's external dissipative forces. It's throwing energy away. So make sure that there are no external forces, or that all of the external forces add up to zero, right? Something on a frictionless table, okay, it's got forces, but force up equals force down. It's like no external forces at all, right? They all, the net external forces are zero. So generally, you'll look for things that are elastic. If these collisions are elastic or if these systems are elastic, you're conserving energy too, and that gives you another equation to work with. And then you set up the problem, tell the story, draw the picture, write down the equations, do the table if you need to. That's all there is to it. Okay, that's all the technique. So far, at least. Now, the problem comes along, and it's only a small problem, but it is a problem when energy is not conserved. And you will have to, at times, figure out from the language of the problem, this is an inelastic collision. I can't use blindly conservation of energy. If things are sticking together, if things are blowing up, if things are deformed because it's a car crash or a piece of putty is hitting something or a bullet is going into a piece of wood and sticking in the piece of wood, right? Generally, if things are sticking to each other in one of the conditions, it's going to be inelastic. The energy is not going to be conserved because it takes energy to pull those things back apart. It took energy away to deform that stuff and get that bullet into the block, right? So be aware that any problem that looks like that, it will not tell you explicitly, ooh, this is an inelastic collision. You better not use conservation of energy, kids, okay? But it's absolutely appropriate that you should not use conservation of energy unless you can take all the energy everywhere within the system and account for it in your table. If you're doing double column, you know, triple column accounting, whatever it is, for all the energy in the system for energy conservation, and you hit a box where you're like, ooh, don't know how to calculate that one. Sorry, can't use conservation of energy. Okay? So generally, objects being blown apart or thrown apart, that's taking chemical energy and converting it to mechanical energy. I don't know the chemical energy originally. Can't use conservation of energy. Okay, so inelastic collisions, though, conservation of momentum applies regardless. So there will be problems that you see where you go, ooh, things are sticking together. I can still use conservation of momentum. And you will have to. So let's take, let's go through a couple of these real quick, and then we'll take a 10-minute break and spend the rest of class working through some example problems. And then next class will be completely review, basically, because once I get through this and get in the center of mass, I'm done with all the material before the exam. But here, let's take a look at a couple of quick questions, right? So I've got two objects coming together, and now they stick. Is that elastic? Is energy conserved? Okay, no. If things are sticking together, they had to put energy into sticking together. Think of it like Velcro or a spring or whatever it is. Some energy got stored in the course of them sticking together. So it took energy out of the system that you can't account for. Is momentum conserved? Is momentum ever not conserved?
Momentum is not conserved whenever there is an external force.
So and there are no external forces here. So if there is an external net force adding in or changing the momentum of the system, if you know that external force, you can account for it. But here, it's a collision. Collision should trigger in your brain, use conservation of momentum. So the momentum is conserved. The energy is not. So the system of two objects after the collision has same amount of total momentum, right, and less kinetic energy, because some of that energy went into sticking them together. So this is the two objects on the spring, right? This is 1 kilogram and 3 kilograms. That I started out with as the first example of conservation of momentum. And you push these things together and store energy in the spring, and you let them go, and they go flying off in opposite directions. So how does the momentum, how are the relative momenta between these two objects? If I let these guys go, which one has more momentum? Remember, what's the initial momentum of the system if none of these things are moving? Zero. Okay. Momentum is MV. If these guys aren't moving, there's no momentum initially. The final momentum is only the momentum of these two things moving in opposite directions now. So what does that say about those final momenta? The total momentum still has to be zero. So the momenta of both of these things moving in opposite directions has to be equal and opposite. Okay? The magnitudes are the same. Even if one is heavier, that just means it's moving at one-third the speed. So this guy, this second block, will be moving at one-third of the speed of the first block. Because he's got three times the mass, but they must have the same momentum. So, but what about the kinetic energies? Okay. This is, if I have the initial energy of the system is all stored in the spring, but afterwards they're both moving off with these different velocities. But remember now that the kinetic energy got these two blocks connected by a spring initially, and then they're both moving off, and this one is moving off with velocity v, this one is moving off with velocity one-third v, because he's got three times the mass of the first guy, right? So the kinetic energy of this guy is one-half mv squared. The kinetic energy of this guy is 1/2 times 3m times 1/3 of the velocity squared, right? 1/2 mv squared,
large block times 1/3,
which is that 3 cancels out 1/3, and I have 1/2 times, I have 1/3 times 1/2 mv squared. Okay, so this is the kinetic energy of the second block. So the second block is 1/3 of the kinetic energy of the first block. Most of the energy of the spring, even though their momenta are equal, most of the energy goes into the smaller guy. Which is great, because imagine that this is not a spring. Imagine this is a cartridge, and this is a rifle, and this is the bullet. Most of the energy goes into the bullet. That's exactly what you want. Most of the energy goes into the smaller mass rather than the larger mass. And in fact, the ratio is the ratio of the masses. So if you got a real small bullet and a real big, gun, or a real big whatever it is that's absorbing that kickback, most of your energy goes into the object being fired.
Firing the bullet faster to break someone's arm does not necessarily force your arm to break.
That's why you have springs and recoil cartridges and things like that. So I think our argument was Ka is equal to Kb times 3. There you go. Kb times 3, right? The B block had 1/3 the kinetic energy of the A block. So the A block has 3 times the kinetic energy of the B block. Right? The smaller guy gets more of the energy. So let's take a break. Let's come back at 10 after, and we'll do another couple of... We'll do vector momentum conservation, and then we'll talk about center of mass. If anybody still didn't get their midterm one, I've got the remaining midterm ones up here.
I presume that after the second midterm, when we talk about rotational motion, we start talking about these balls impacting each other, not directly on.
So that actually is complicated enough to get into it on the real underground mechanics. So we will, I do have. I mean, the classic, the kind of classic reduced form problem, or the simple problem, is this.
And that is,
a whole bunch of music.
But at some point, like, get less energy on the other side because it's sitting there.
For this part, this is an
You're not really getting your maximum effective impulse. There was a lot more energy that could have been put into that round if you had lengthened the barrel. Why is 308 shooting rifles? Usually we have a decent size. But if you made that barrel 20 feet, so much energy would be lost. And the bullet's compressive force would be lost too, because you're coming at it so much harder than the bullet. So I wonder if it's like a maximum effective. The amount of time the round is exposed to force, which would effectively be the length of the barrel.
Let's take a look and see real quick because the because this got a couple of us too, so.
Right. was really super silly. Like, you could simulate a billion yards and be like a pinhead, but like, you might hit it.
Yeah.
But you never would have hit it. Like,
yeah.
Your weapon can't go that well.
It's so silly.
So,
yeah,
let's So there was a. Was it this problem? Let's see. No, it's not that problem. It's Oh no, that one was a tough problem actually.
Go up. I think it's 5 point.
Oh no, that's a glider. So let's see.
Oh.
This one?
Oh yeah.
Is it this one? Okay, right. So in your in here it says you're lowering the boxes, so the velocity is going down.
Mm-hmm.
So the force of friction is going up.
Okay. All right.
So and the force of friction is going up for both boxes because this box, if there was no friction, this box would slide down.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So force of friction must be going up for both boxes.
So multiply the correction.
So here, so if you're lowering, so you're lowering the material, now the constant velocity. Okay. So these boxes are moving at a constant velocity. Let's call this one and three. So for box two, there's the force you're exerting, right? There's some weight on the first box.
Probably would be able to hold it. Like it probably
and
go
there's
that.
The force you're exerting. There's also some
but I don't think it'll still be in your
which goes against the velocity.
I doubt it. Like,
and
I don't
for
think
the first box,
I don't
okay. For this first box, we've got the force of ground.
I know I'm way too small.
And we've got the normal force.
No.
And it's got some force of friction. This force of friction from box 20 points that way. This it must be countered by the force of friction here. Because these two are equal and opposite days on their box. So you need to calculate this box first. Then you can calculate everything for this box because you need to include this force of friction. Okay? Okay, yeah. And there's also there's also a normal force one here. Right? Because these two normal forces are also forces between the two. So you have to be very careful about that middle box. I think I'll try and draw the solution. Okay.
And they have like a big
So here's a conservation of momentum problem in two dimensions, right? So this is like the two boxes raining between them, blowing apart and pushing each other apart. Now I've got a firecracker that blows itself apart into three chunks, and those three pieces all fly off in different directions. So now, since there are multiple directions involved, we have to use conservation of momentum in multiple dimensions, of course. So, which again is just like conservation of momentum in one dimension, except you gotta decompose your vectors and be a little bit careful about things. So what's the magnitude and direction of the momentum of the third piece? And notice I'm asking for magnitude and direction of momentum of the third piece. Momentum is a vector. So we can work through this, and we've got this initial system and the initial momentum of the system is zero because the firecracker is at rest. Right, so the initial total momentum of the system is zero, which means that all the final momenta need to add up to zero in a vector way as well. So that means that the x net momentum final better be zero, and the y net momentum better be zero too. So we've got I drew the two pieces that we know about. One is going in the positive y direction at 300 grams at 45 meters per second. One is going in the x direction, 200 grams, 82 meters per second. Let's call this M1 and V1. Let's call this M2 and V2. And then all we know about this guy is we aren't asked for his mass or his velocity. We can't figure those out independently. All we can figure out is its momentum. But we can figure out its p3y and p3x components of that momentum because it's a vector. Right? So the x equation gives us m2 v2 minus p3x is equal to zero. And the y equation gives us m1 v1, and then the y component of p3 is also pointing down, so it's negative. And p3y is then m1 v1. And we know that they're pointing in the negative direction. But now all we have to do is multiply out the numbers. The total momentum then will be the square root of p3x squared plus p3y squared. And if that angle is theta, and the tangent of theta will equal the opposite over the adjacent, like p3x over p3y. We can plug those numbers in and go from there. But again, looking at a problem like this, it's just vectors, it's just break it down into components, draw the picture, break it down into components, and then use conservation of momentum in each direction. And you can't use conservation of energy with this one. I like waving my hand in front of this thing, it looks fun. You can't use conservation of energy here because this is an explosion problem. unfortunately, you don't need to. But there, yes. Yeah. Oh, sure. Sorry. Right. So the tangent, SOHCAHTOA, mm-hmm. right? I drew theta there. So the tangent is the opposite over the adjacent. So P3X over P3Y. And that'll figure out that angle. And then you can really say it's 90 degrees plus that angle below the positive x-axis or something like that, right? So. But generally, the way I always do it, and different people have been taught to do it different ways, but I'm really stuck. I really like drawing the triangle and figuring out an angle that's less than 90 degrees,
oh.
and then adding in the appropriate 90 degrees because you drew the picture to get to the final number, because it always works. It's very easy to get signs wrong if you're trying to remember, ooh, in the third quadrant I need to use this rule, and in the second quadrant I need to use that rule. If you draw the triangle and just use the lengths of the sides, it always works.
Okay.
Yeah?
Now that you know the momentum of various pieces, can you use that to go back and calculate the chemical energy of a firework?
So the question is, could I then figure out how much energy I had expended in the firework? Okay, well, I can figure out the kinetic energy for this guy, 1/2 mv². I can figure out the kinetic energy for this guy, 1/2 mv². I'm going to have a hard time figuring out the kinetic energy for this guy unless I know his mass. Because I know his total momentum, but I don't know how much of that is mass and how much of that is velocity. And going from mv to 1/2 mv², I need to know the mass, right? So then use the velocity and calculate from there. So I don't have enough information a priori here to figure out the chemical energy of the firework, unless I know the mass of that. If I give you the mass of that last piece, yes, then you'll know everything. Okay. And if that last piece could be really big, right? It could have just blown off two chunks and hopped a little bit. Or it could be really small and it could have gone off like a bullet in that direction. But the total energy expended is going to be different in both cases. Does that answer your question? Good. Okay. So let's see. So a somewhat harder. So I started off in one-dimensional motion with an explosion problem, right? Spraying in two objects, zero net momentum initially, zero total momentum finally. And then I went into a one-dimensional collision problem. We just did a two-dimensional explosion problem, zero net momentum initially, and now we're going to do a two-dimensional collision problem. And this is an elastic collision problem where, of course, you have to set it up using conservation of energy and all that stuff, too. Right? So I've got a billiard ball, and the billiard ball is hitting another billiard ball, and they're angling off. One angle is off at 30 degrees from its original direction. So I've got an initial and a final picture here, where I've got an initial ball coming in, and the masses of both of these balls are the same. And there's a V1 initial. And then what's happening is the two balls are going off in different directions. And now it may feel like you don't have enough information to do this problem, right? You've got an initial picture that looks like that, where I've just got a mass, two masses, and one billiard ball coming in about to hit the other ball, and then they tear them off of each other, and I've got this final state where this is V1 final and this is V2 final. Now, those are real vectors because it's going off of an angle. And so now what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to write down conservation momentum. And this is theta 1 is 30 degrees. I don't know theta 2. But I do know both of these masses are equal at least. So what have I got? I've got my initial momentum. P initial, and let's say P initial x is equal to mv1i, right? In my initial picture, I only have one initial momentum horizontally. And in fact, I have no vertical momentum. Nothing's moving in the y direction. And this was elastic. So I can also say my kinetic energy initial is equal to 1/2 mv1i squared. Okay? I'm going to have to use a little bit of trig or be careful about decomposing these vectors for these final momenta. So P final x, well, there are two components pointing in the positive x direction, right? And that's P1 times the cosine of theta adjacent side, so is P1 final cosine theta 1 plus P2 final cosine theta 2. I'm just taking the components of these two vectors here in the x direction. And I know theta 1, but I don't know, and I know both of the masses, but I don't know the final velocities. P final y is equal to P1 final times the sine of theta 1. And now the y component of the momentum for the second guy is pointing downward, minus P2 final and the sine of theta 2. Right, those are the two y components. Now I have the kinetic energy final here is equal to 1/2 times m v1 final squared plus 1/2 m v2 final squared. Okay? So far, so good. Pretty much very close to all the physics is done now. Because I drew the pictures, I wrote them down the components, and I wrote down the relevant quantities because now I'm going to use, okay, conservation of momentum. Let's use conservation of energy first. The kinetic energy initial is equal to the kinetic energy final. So I'm setting this equal to that. All the 1/2s cancel out, all of the m's cancel out. I end up having v1i squared is equal to v1f squared plus v2f squared. So that comes out of, that's one equation where now I have two unknowns. I don't know these two final velocities. I do know the initial velocity because I was given it. And then the conservation of momentum. Let's look at it in the y direction first, because in the y direction, the initial momentum was zero. So conservation of momentum in the y direction, initial is zero, final is p1f times the sine of theta 1 minus p2f times the sine of theta 2. Remember, momentum is just mass times velocity. Both of the masses are the same, so they drop out. So what I have is I end up getting from this v1 final times the sine of theta 1 is equal to v2 final times the sine of theta 2. Okay, I got that from equating those two. Now already you can see, right, I still have two equations. I have this equation, which is two unknowns, V1F and V2F. I have this equation, which is three unknowns, right? Theta 2 I don't know, and the two velocities I don't know. So I need one more equation. And that one more equation comes from conservation of horizontal momentum. In conservation of horizontal momentum, where'd my purple marker go? Right, set those two guys equal to each other. Now I end up having mv1i is equal to p1f cosine theta 1 plus cosine theta 2. The masses all end up canceling out. What I have is V1i is equal to V1f cosine theta 1 plus V2f cosine theta 2. So now I have three equations. It's a lot of algebra. Long haul to get there. The underlying physics principle is very simple, right? Conservation of momentum. The mechanics of it all, the technique, is painful and sloggy because you have to write down all the vector components and use all the vector math to get there. But once you get there, So just to reassure you of the process, does anybody want to see me actually work through how to solve for the three variables that are unknown here?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because three variables, three unknowns is a little bit heavy, right? Or is a little bit painful. Oh my God, look, it's a loop-de-loop. Some people don't erase the boards. Do the zoom out just a little bit so I can use the full board. Okay. So I have three equations, three unknowns. Right, I have V1I squared is equal to V1F squared plus V2F squared. Okay. I have V1F sine theta is equal to V2F sine theta 2. And I have V1I is equal to V1F cosine theta 1 plus V2F times the cosine of theta 2. Okay, so I've got three equations and three unknowns. Usually, when you're doing this for the first time, it's good to write down, remind yourself what the unknowns are, right? It's V1F, V2F, and theta 2. Right, everything else I was given in the problem. This initial velocity, the final angle for theta 1, I was given all of those. So now what I want to do is I want to try and solve these equations for these two guys. So let's label the equations 1, 2, and 3. And equation 1 involves V1F and V2F. Equation 2 involves V1F, V2F, and theta 2. And equation 3 involves V1F, V2F, and theta 2, 2. Okay. So it's not like I can immediately pair any of these together and get out what I need. So generally what I try and do, the advice on something like this, and this is particularly true in conservation of energy problems where you end up having lots of squares around, is do not succumb to the temptation to solve equation one, you know, take V1F is equal to blah, blah, square root V2F squared, etc. Right, because then you're going to have square roots floating around when you substitute it in the other equations. That's going to be a mess. Here the general rule of thumb is to solve the linear things first. If you solve the linear things first, which would mean solving equations 2 and 3 and reducing those somehow, it'll help a lot. Okay? So what you have here, we know this equation 2 is actually relatively straightforward because it's a ratio of the two velocities is equal to a ratio of the sines of the angles, right? So sine of theta 2. Generally, what I'm going to try and do is I'm going to try and solve for theta 2 first out of all of this, if we can. So solving the linear things first out of these two. You see, I mean, it's even a little bit tricky for me. By the way, in the midterm, if you get to this point, you're at 90% credit already. Okay, so don't worry about all of this painful stuff because there are plenty of things on the internet where you type in these equations, like Mathematica, plenty of tools, where you type in these equations and say solve it and it gives you the numbers back. Doing this algebra is not a critical life skill, okay? There's, as a matter of fact, that's exactly why I'm suffering through this. What I would do if I have to do this, and I do now, right, is I would try and solve, I would take equation 2, which looks very amenable to me already, right? D1F times sine theta 1 is a number. And what I then have is I have V1F times sine theta 1 is, just to get that out, V1F times sine theta 1 is some number, let's say, which is V2F sine of theta 2. Okay? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to square that. This thing squared is equal to V. 2f squared sine squared of theta 2. Okay? And I'm doing that because I know that this thing is sine squared plus cosine squared is 1. What I really want to get is a cosine out of here. And I know that this is a 1 minus the cosine squared of theta 2. Right, so then I can get theta 2 in terms of E2F. I can solve this, right? I can move V2F over in the denominator of this. I can move the 1 over, the cosine over, and take a square root. So I can end up getting a cosine of theta 2 in terms of V2F from equation 2. I used equation 2, so I can't use it anymore. But then I know that I'm taking this cosine theta 2 and plugging it in there. And that eliminates theta 2. And now I've got two equations. They're only in terms of these things that I know, and V1F and V2F. So the trick here is to first eliminate, solve the linear things first, and get rid of the trig terms first. And then what I have is I have two equations and two unknowns that I try and solve and go from there. So that's how I do it, okay? There's a couple of hints in there. Three equations, three unknowns with trig and with quadratics. Don't solve the quadratic and plug it into the others. Take the easiest linear equation, solve it for the trig thing and plug it into the trig thing and reduce from there. That's kind of the fastest thing in my mind as an experienced person doing this. But again, don't completely sweat it. So we'll cover center of mass next time. We'll cover one more inelastic collision, because I really want to do the bullet and the block problem, because it's a standard problem of all of this. Then we'll do center of mass and review on Monday.
Inelastic collision.